That smoothest series of notes I know make up Ray Lynch's hypnotic Clouds Below Your Knees. And it always signals that it is 8 p.m. on Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling right here on listener-sponsored KPFT. I'm Greg Audell, co-host of this amazing little program, and along with our team of co-hosts, Mary Edgerton, Warren Holloman, Hank Rubicek, engineer extraordinaire Nicole Rocherlin, and production intern Tatiana Gago, and last but certainly not least, Floyd the Wonder Dog. I am privileged to be your guide, taking you on a magical journey through the eyes of storytellers. And tonight I'll be placing the spotlight on a trio of outstanding tellers who help us do what we do each and every week. We share the power of stories. And tonight they'll do it by conveying their reflections about the fragile nature of life and how vulnerabilities, one of the strongest common denominators among human beings, gave them strength and meaning. So sit back and relax, and let's enjoy some stories. Elizabeth Ruiz is an expert in organizational communication. Her passion is helping people to improve behavior so that they can reach their potential in both their business and individual lives. I am clearly going to have to talk to Elizabeth when this is done. I need someone like that in my life. Elizabeth completed a Bachelor of Science Communication at U of H downtown and plans to pursue a master's. She spends time mentoring, creating leaders, and volunteering because giving back to the community is, in her words, the foundation for successful training is learning. Let me get that again. The foundation for successful training is learning. Among her many accolades, Elizabeth recently earned first place in the second annual University of Houston Downtown Public Speaking Competition. I look forward to hearing some more about that. Joseph Espithia, did I get that right, Joseph?
Nailed it.
All right. Is a native Houstonian who was first in his family to graduate college, receiving a degree in political science. All right. Good fellow political science major from Texas State University in San Marcos. Like all of us political science majors, he is now doing something else. He works in natural gas trading as a scheduler and is eager to undertake new adventures, which can lead to new stories. He does sound like one of us. I think that's how every storyteller looks at life. You know, there's good, bad, but everything's a story. Like many of us who you hear on this program, as we've done over the years, Joseph recently got up his nerve to step onto that Moth stage for the very first time a few months ago. And wouldn't you know it, last week's Moth, and a night filled with great storytellers, he emerged victorious. That is no small feat, my friend. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I'm proud of you. And last but certainly not least, Harwood Taylor is a longtime friend of this program and is also a former Moth Story Slam champion. Harwood is always able to lead me into his stories so thoroughly, I often forget where I am, and that's the mark of a gifted storyteller. And Harwood, thank you for joining us. It is always a special evening when you are here.
Well, it's always special when I'm here. Thank you for inviting me.
And Elizabeth, welcome to the studios.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I understand you've been in this studio before on a program, but this is your first time on So What's Your Story. Is that correct?
Correct.
Well, I am glad we have you. And Joseph, have you been on radio before?
Never. This is a first for me.
All right. Well, I can already tell you've got a good radio voice, so you don't have to worry about that.
Right on.
No, I am really, really excited to have all of you here. Now, Elizabeth, you've been in the communication business for over 30 years. Is that correct?
Correct. 32.
Wow. What is it about the discipline that captivates you and keeps you interested in all this after all this time?
Well, actually, nonverbal communication to me is the most important. It's the majority of communication. You can tell a lot about someone by watching them and then speaking with them afterwards. I enjoy communication, and I also like to people watch. The thing that I really like is
another mark of a good storyteller.
Yes, you can make up a lot of stories by just people watching.
Absolutely. What is it that intrigues you about crafting a good story?
That's a very good question. I would say right now, inspiring people.
Oh, wow. I like that. I wasn't expecting that answer. Your first story reminds us of the absolute unpredictability and fragility of life. Would you tell us your story?
Yes. Well, I want you to imagine getting a call right now from a person you love the most. They tell you they are trapped hundreds of miles away and have a few seconds to live. I wanted to tell you that they love you and goodbye. This happened to me. I was trapped under 7 stories of rubble, soot, and debris with my children. Thought I was going to die any second. I had cell phone reception and called my mother to tell her goodbye. What would you do? Today, I'm going to tell you my story and how it changed my life. It was a bright, early, sunny morning when I was getting my 3-year-old ready for his first day of preschool when I heard a loud explosion. It sounded like a bomb going off. It shook our high-rise. I immediately ran to pull my older son out of school. It was behind our apartment building, and we ran into a fleeing crowd of thousands of people to try to get our car out of the garage. By the time we made it, it was roped off, and we were ordered to run towards the water. Then a second plane was coming. Halfway, running back to my building, we watched the second plane fly into the World Trade Center. We were frozen, watching it burn and people jumping to their death, hearing their bodies hit the pavement. It was horrific. I felt the building was about to fall, so I ran to my apartment building across the street from World Trade Center to grab a few things before fleeing out of New York. We took the elevator to the 12th floor, but in a few seconds, a fireman broke down our door and told us to run down the stairs and run towards the water immediately. By the time we hit the first floor, we witnessed the sunny day turn black, soot and debris fall all around us. We found ourselves in the basement of our apartment with a group of strangers. I organized the 7 adults in a circle and the 6 children in a circle inside the adult circle. Knowing my children were about to die, I began organizing the group. It was chaos. I was organizing it into peace and calm as much as I could for them, for my children's sake. My cell phone miraculously had service. I shared with the group. I would make the first call for 2 minutes, then pass the phone to the person on my right, and so on until the phone dropped connection. We all called a loved one to tell them we were trapped in a basement, that we loved them and goodbye. No one called for help. We all knew we were going to die any second. Everyone had a chance to make a call before service died. 2 hours later, New York firemen found us. We were the last group of people to be found alive. We had just the clothes on our backs and lost everything. We had to rebuild our lives. We lived in 3 hotels and temporary housing for a year until we found another place to live. I have used this event to help others. I have gone back to school to finish my degree and inspire others to not wait for a 9/11 to happen, to rise to the top, follow who you are now. Don't wait. You can thrive no matter what. There is greatness in all of us, and sometimes it goes untapped until a crisis. Find your potential now. Don't wait. I would like to leave you with this. Decide to go for your dreams now and make a call to someone you love tonight to say hello, not goodbye.
Wow, Elizabeth. I can understand how you can't tell that with a dry eye. It's hard to hear with a dry eye. That may be one of the most powerful stories I've heard. I mean, your story is such a powerful reminder that every victim of the 9/11 attack started their day as normally as any day of their lives. In a day filled with memories, what is your most vivid memory of that day?
Holding my children in my arms.
What is their most vivid memory?
Unfortunately, the second plane hitting the building and people falling.
And how old were they at the time?
3 and 7.
Does a one who is three have any memories?
Well, when he was three, he would talk. Back then, Digimon was very popular, and he would tell us that Digimon was in the Hudson River, and he was going to find the terrorists. So that was his memory.
Now, all these years later, how has it impacted them, or is it something that's not discussed much?
No, we talk about it during 9/11 anniversary. When you're a survivor, you're registered with the World Trade Center Health Registry, and they email you a questionnaire, and you have to answer questions about your mental and physical health, and they keep a permanent record of it, and they post it for the public to read annually. And wow. So we do have to go through that.
Have your children written their own stories?
No, they have not. Actually, my 19-year-old, who was three at the time, he has written two papers on it. And he also made a speech about it as well at his college.
Wow. Wow.
My older son... He is, he's in the Navy. He's in the military. He's a Navy nuclear engineer fighting for our country now.
Wow. Wow, you've got a lot to be proud of. And yes. You know what? So do they. They have a lot to be proud of in you.
Thank you.
Do you feel that? Do you recognize that? I can see in your face you're not so sure.
I'm very proud of my children, so... Well, I try to do the best.
I always tell people, you know, my motto is good kids do not just happen.
I agree.
Well, my friends, you're listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. My guest storytellers are Elizabeth Ruiz, Joseph Espithia, and Harwood Taylor. Tonight, we are proud to have Tatiana Gago helping us behind the control room. And how have your holidays been?
They've been really relaxing. Oh. I got to sleep so much.
Oh, I am so jealous of you. I'm so jealous of you. You know, as you might be aware, our city is absolutely crawling with storytellers. Would you be so kind as to let folks know where they can hear some of these roaming storytellers around our fair city?
Oh, absolutely. So to start, everyone needs to follow us on our Facebook.
Yes.
And please share our page with your friends and click like on our page so everyone knows that you really, really like us.
And they will think you are so hip and so cool.
Okay. We have program clips on YouTube and all of our past So What's Your Story programs on the Houston Storytellers website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Just go to the radio program link on their site and enjoy. The Guild is also our proud sponsor. Their swaps meet the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. Also, don't miss our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of the month.
You know, and the reason these groups are so important is I think the best way I can tell you not to become better at telling stories is to sit alone in your room and talk to yourself. You got to get out there with other storytellers and see how other people tell their stories, how they put their stories together. It's like anything else. It is a skill, and you're just not going to get much better at it unless you surround yourself with others that have been doing it a while. Thanks, Tatiana. This is Greg Audell, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? Now, Joseph, I want to thank you for making the effort to be here tonight, because I understand that we are about to lose you to Utah?
Unfortunately,
in
yes.
In the very near future, what in the world is dragging you from the Houston storytelling scene to Utah?
I know. And, you know, I wish I had a more interesting story for my reasons of leaving, but it really is because of my job. And, you know, I'm hoping... this kind of transition can kind of lead to newer stories and more exciting tales to be told.
Well, I would say that attitude might well come from one of the stories you're going to share with us tonight. I mean, like me, you were lucky enough to spend part of your 20s in what I consider the most amazing city on the face of the earth, Washington, D.C. What did you think of the place after that buildup?
You know what? I loved it. I wouldn't mind going back anytime soon. I mean, it's just a level of diversity It is just an energy that can't be matched, maybe with New York or something. But
well, it's also, if you're going to be broke, it's the world's best city to be broke in. All the museums are free.
Absolutely.
There's always something going on the mall. I mean, you can live very, and then you can just sneak into receptions, as I'm not going to admit whether I did or not, but there's always receptions. Every hotel you go to there.
Of course.
Would you share your story with us?
Absolutely. Okay, so about 5 years ago, I'm in my apartment in San Marcos, Texas, and I'm a junior in college at this time, and I'm eagerly waiting a phone call from the Houston Astros. I had just interviewed with them the week prior, and I was waiting for a phone call because they said they would call me to let me know if I, you know, received the internship or not. And so as I'm waiting and I'm waiting and I'm waiting, I eventually get a phone call, but it's from Washington, D.C. And the man on the other end of this line, you know, he sounds like Dana Carvey's impression of Ross Perot. And to me, it sounds hokey. I'm like, there's no way this is real. And he's explaining to me, you know, I found your application online, something I had filled out months prior. And he explains to me, how would you like to intern at the Library of Congress in D.C.? It would be fully paid. We would pay for your flight, your apartment, and we would also pay you for your work. So once again, this sounds too good to be true. And the more I'm talking to him, the more I'm like, okay, I'm doing this. I'm definitely doing this. So, you know, I'm so happy about this. And I tell my friends and they plan a big celebration for me and I'm super excited about it. And all my friends come out. We go, you know, it's San Marcos. A lot of people like to have fun there. So
really?
Oh, yeah. So everybody comes out and, you know, it's bittersweet because people are, you know, this may be the last time they ever see me, depending on how this goes. And so, you know, for 4 months, I'll be gone. And so after the celebration, I go on my way. And at the time, you know, I tell my girlfriend at the time, I got to go. I love you. I'm sorry. But, you know, this has to happen. And we're going to try to maintain everything. And once I'm there, you know, going experiencing the city, learning the ins and outs, and it's just a wonderful place. Like you said, there's always something to do. There's never a dull moment. And at a certain point in time, I get invited to a gala, a really nice Library of Congress gala. It's a black tie affair. I'm totally unfamiliar with this. I don't know what it is. I'm out of my element with these kind of things. You know what I mean? I'm just a 21-year-old kid who's being thrown to the wolves, basically. And this was probably the later half of my internship. And right before this, I had just been dumped. She could no longer be in the long-distance relationship. And I was just heartbroken, devastated. It was terrible. And so, naturally, I'm not too excited about this gala, but I'm trying to make the best of it. And once I go to it, the library itself is just lit up. It is beautiful. It's empty. I mean, usually there's tourists everywhere. And it's just crawling with Pulitzer Prize winners, Nobel Prize winners, celebrities. I'm totally out of my element once again. You know what I mean? And there's food. And I don't want to eat the food because I feel like that would be tacky. And their drinks are flowing. And it's just beautiful. It's gorgeous. Well, as the night goes on, it ends up being this huge dance party. And it's nothing but, you know, the younger interns like myself having the grand old time. And it's the most unprofessional thing I've ever seen. And so as I'm there and I'm sad and I'm not really enjoying it and I'm just totally in my own head, I slowly start coming around little by little. And so I go and I grab my boss and I bring him out there to the dance floor and we start dancing and acting goofy. I go and grab his bosses. These are all government officials, you know what I mean? I grab all these people, we're out there dancing and they're with the 20-plus-year-olds and we're having a grand old time. And I took a minute after that and I walk away and I walk to the bar to get drinks and I look around and I look at this grand celebration, this massive thing that I never thought I would be part of. And it's amazing. It's epic. And it really put things in perspective for me. Here I am wallowing in whatever I'm dealing with. And none of these people know what I'm dealing with. They have no idea, right? And so that truly does put things in perspective. And I see, wow, like this, look at the grand scheme of things here, buddy. Look what's going on. So that pretty much wrapped up my internship in D.C. And soon after that, I was on my way home. And so if you look at it, my internship, it started with a celebration and it ended with a celebration. And in between, there were some really valuable lessons learned with that.
Wow. I can picture myself in every bit of that story. I remember being 21 years old at a reception at the State Department, and this very old man came past me, and it was Armin Hammer, the grandfather of the actor. And just like you, I was like, what business do I have talking to Armin Hammer? I mean, what business? And then you realize, wow, all these important people got here because they were 21-year-old kids once, you know?
Absolutely.
And, yeah, you really do a good job of capturing, you know, what it is like to be 21 in D.C. As we are in the midst of the holiday season, I would love to hear your story about Thanksgiving, if you'd share your second story with us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my time in D.C., I'm away from family, and I don't really have Thanksgiving plans. And, you know, word of mouth, it became known that I could possibly go to Baltimore for Thanksgiving and spend time with a family I had never met. And so, naturally, that's a little weird for anyone. So I said, you know what, sure, we'll do that. And so this is my first time ever being on a train going from city to city. And so anyone who lives in Texas all their life, this is totally foreign to you, that you could hop on a train and be in a city within a matter of minutes, you know. So I go to Baltimore, and I'm extremely nervous about this situation. I'm extremely, I guess, a little uncomfortable because I've never done anything like this. I've never been on a train like this to go from city to city. And what you don't realize is that you really have to pay attention with these kind of train rides, because they don't warn you that you're approaching your stop, per se. They don't really make an official announcement. And it's just kind of like you got to be paying attention when they stop and look outside the window and see where you are. And so I was really close to missing my stop. And fortunately, I caught it in time. So when I get off the train, I walk off and I go into the train station, and I see this older African-American gentleman. He's wearing a golf cap. He's wearing a denim jacket. He's very stylish looking, and he's holding a makeshift little cardboard sign with my name on it. And so I was like, okay, clearly he's here for me. So I go up and I introduce myself, and he says, yeah, I'm here to pick you up. I'm going to take you where you need to go. So where I was going, it was this how do I explain this? The woman that I had been talking to up to this point, she was a grandmother, she was an aunt, she was a mother, she was, you know, just the quintessential mother of the, I guess you could say, the head of the family, so to speak. And so we had been talking up to this point. She was super nice and super inviting and super welcoming. So we get in his car, and of course he's driving this old Monte Carlo, and it's just very fitting for the kind of gentleman that he is and the way he looks. And I'm like, okay, this should be interesting. And so we go on our way downtown Baltimore, and he's showing me Johns Hopkins, and he's showing me where the Orioles play. And I'm thinking, okay, that's pretty cool. And we're still on our way. And then he says, okay, well, I'm going to make a stop real quick. I hope you don't mind. And, you know, what can I say? I'm visiting. So sure. Yeah, let's do it. So we pull over to the side of the road, and the part of town that we're in, it's, if you're familiar with the show The Wire, this is where they filmed The Wire, and he let me know that right away.
Wow.
So you can get a pretty good idea of the demographic, the situation. So we stop at some project housing, and he gets out, and he's walking towards the sidewalk, and I get out right. He's like, well, you can get out if you want. And I'm like, okay, sure. I have no idea where I'm at. Of course I'll get out. So I start following him, and there's a gentleman standing in front of this house on the sidewalk, and his back is facing me. And he turns around, and he says, oh, hey, uncle. And he's referring to the gentleman I'm with. But when I look at the guy, I notice he's buckling and zipping his pants up, and I'm thinking, what is going on here? And he has this long urine stain all the way to his foot, and I'm thinking, okay, this is a little bizarre. But he doesn't acknowledge it. No one acknowledges it for some reason. It's just it's a thing. So he greets his uncle, and then he tries to greet me, but naturally I'm reluctant because I don't know what just happened. So I try to weasel my way out of it by, you know, pointing at something or making a reference to something. So then the gentleman that's driving me, he goes inside, and I have no idea what he did. He's gone for about 15 minutes, and I'm still standing on this sidewalk, and I'm looking around, and I see families passing by, young mothers passing by with their kids. It's a very active neighborhood, and I'm thinking, where am I? And I stick out like a sore thumb, you know what I mean? Clearly, I'm not from there. So then he comes back outside and he says, okay, you ready to go? And I'm like, yeah, of course I'm ready to go. I don't know where we are. What's going on? I'm trying to get to this house for Thanksgiving. So then we eventually leave. Once we get going, he says, hey, I got to make one more stop. And I'm thinking, oh boy, I'm never going to get to this house. We stop at his house this time. His daughter's in the house. She's cooking. She's with her daughters, his grandkids. And he sits me in the living room. He says, I'll be right back. And he goes upstairs. And then when I look at his wall, he's got this 8-foot shelf and it's about 4 foot high and it's filled with albums, nothing but albums. And he's got this amazing turntable and I'm blown away. I'm like, this, who knew this existed in this man's house? I had no idea. And so he comes back downstairs. I'm like, what is this about? You know? And he starts explaining his love for music, which I also have a love for music. So we start bonding on that. So immediately we start clicking and it feels very natural. And I'm thinking, this is like a hidden gem. If people only knew this existed in this little run down dilapidated house, there is this amazing record collection. So he says, hey, are you ready to go? Once again, I'm still, yes, I've been ready for a while. I feel like I've been in Baltimore all day. Eventually we leave. We finally get to where we need to be. I walk into this house. There's nobody in it except for this woman, this older, she's probably mid 60s. And she's got this huge grin on her face and she's so welcoming and she's in the kitchen and she's cooking everything from fried chicken to crab soup to turkey to ham. I mean, this woman is doing it all. And I'm thinking, oh boy, am I early because there's no one here? And she explains to me, no, I probably wouldn't have done anything if you wouldn't have come. We would have kept it simple. I probably would have gone somewhere. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you did this for me? She's like, well, yeah. So she sits me in the living room, and the Texans are playing that day. So she wants me to watch the game, and I'm watching it. She comes in, and she serves me, and I'm blown away by this. And then, you know, later in the evening, little by little, some of her family members stop by. But by no means was there ever a formal sit-down with the entire family at a table. Wow. And I'm thinking, this woman just did all of this for me. Somebody she's never met. She doesn't know what I look like. She just did this. This is how awesome she is, a genuine person. And so I get on the train that night, and as they drive me back to the train station, I'm kind of reflecting on the day, and of course she gives me a plate to go, and I'm on the train, I'm on my way back to DC, and in my head I'm like, wow, I was so nervous to go to this Thanksgiving dinner, and in that moment I just felt totally at ease going back to DC. I was so comfortable and fulfilled with a family I had never met. It was amazing.
Wow. It is an amazing story. There's so much to remind us of what and who and how we should be focused on during the holidays, as opposed to all the other garbage that gets in the way, I think. You know, I feel like what happened to you was so pure.
Absolutely.
How did you come to be invited to this woman's house?
So it ended up being a family friend that was back in Houston. Okay. That said, hey, if you're not doing anything, you could always go up to Baltimore. And that's how it all kind of came to fruition.
And, you know, I got to tell you what's funny. I've been on a train once in my life from D.C. to Baltimore for Thanksgiving.
No kidding.
Absolutely. My uncle lived in Baltimore.
What are the odds?
Yeah, yeah. So that's a wonderful story. And I don't even – part of a good story is I don't know much about this lady, but I love her from your story.
Yeah,
you know, I have a picture of her in my mind. I can picture her kitchen, bringing the food to you. That's beautiful.
In the beginning of this, it sounds so bizarre, and who knew it would end at such a positive note? You know,
but that's
I mean?
Really true with both of your stories. That when you're willing to go down a path, you're really not sure where it's going to lead. It's amazing what you might find.
Absolutely.
You know, remember what we always say: everyone is a storyteller. But as with every skill, to become stronger, you must practice to learn what works for you and what doesn't. And that brings us to Tips for the Tellers, where we will help you darn your yarn. We strive to provide tips that will help you develop your storytelling skills and your confidence, because that's a big part of storytelling. An insightful teacher of storytelling who I read up on a good bit is named Aaron Shepherd, and if I can tell you, his site is aaronshep.com, and he's got a lot of good insights and advice. I'm going to quote just a little bit here. Storytellers learn their stories in different ways. Some read or listen to a story over and over. Some meditate on it. Some type or write out the story. However you do it, you must absorb the story until it becomes second nature. Find the best way that works for you. Now, some parts of the story, they can be memorized word for word. Some parts. Beautiful beginnings, eloquent endings, important dialogue, colorful expressions, rhymes and repeated phrases. All that's good. Those are good tools to have in your arsenal. But don't try to memorize an entire story that way, because strict reciting creates a distance from your listeners, and that is very hard to bridge. You know, we don't ask people to recite stories. We ask them to tell stories or share stories. You know, instead, picture the story in your mind. See the scenes as clearly as you can. Later, these pictures will help you recreate your story as you tell it, whether or not you consciously call them to mind. And it's funny, the points he makes are something we talk about all the time on the show, because the most frequent question I get from guests is, you know, do I need to write out my story? Do I need to read my story? Is it okay if I read my story? Or can I not tell my story? And we tell them, we're like, what works for you is the right way. And Dr. Rubicek, you know, one of my very early months on the show, told me, and it was a very kind thing he said. He said, Greg, you know, because I don't write down my stories, he said, your way would not work for me. And my way would not work for you. So you need to do what works. And it was the best storytelling advice I've ever been given, because it gave me the freedom to know the right way is the way that works for me. And that's what I tell every new storyteller. Now, Harwood, you have been around the storytelling world longer and more successfully than I have. What tip would you give someone about crafting a story?
You know, for me, it's just something that's important to me, you know, that's something that moved me. And it can be the most ordinary thing, which the story that I'm about to tell is, it's not some epic event. It was an epic event because of what was going on in my mind and the history that I had with, you know, my dad. But, and I think a friend of mine said, you know, just, I asked him, I told him I was going on and I was nervous because I always get nervous. And I made a, just a deal with myself that fear was going to be my friend in storytelling. Mm. And that instead of trying to resist it, I would just say, okay, we're going to go together to this thing I do called storytelling. And part of that is with being with my buddy Fear. So, you know, invited to the party, you know, fear can be a way of, you know, making us more aware. You know, that's what we did in hundreds right. of years ago when we were hunting bison or whatever we were doing. Thousands of years ago, I guess, hundreds of years.
You know, I think something similarly, just a little bit differently. You know, I've gone through this with you backstage before when I was starting to feel nerves coming on. One thing I have told myself, and it sounds ridiculous, but it's true. If I feel nervousness coming on, I just say, nope, nervousness is not allowed. Anxiousness is. It's okay if I'm a little anxious. Anxious can be healthy.
Okay.
But nervous, for me, there's nothing good in nervous. So I just say,
gotcha.
I'm now, it's nervousness is not allowed today.
Right.
And I remember doing that with you at the Moth stage. I could feel it coming on, but you were so calm. I was like, no, I'm not going to be nervous. Anxious is okay, but nervous is not.
And it's good to have friends in the audience that know your story well, because that's what happened to me at the Grand Slam. I just completely went blank and I was thinking, wow, this is going to be a really dramatic, exit of the stage with silence, and my friend yelled out the line, and
oh, that's
and
nice.
It was fine.
Well, let me tell you something about that. Another great thing that I heard about performing was from Dolly Parton, of all people. It was in a TV interview. She said
she
starts every concert by apologizing to the audience. And she says, you know, I want to apologize for the mistakes I'm going to make, because I've been doing this for 50 years. I've never had a show yet where I didn't make a mistake. I thought, you know what? If you just go into it knowing you're going to do your absolute very best,
right?
The audience is there for you,
yeah.
But very few people have ever had a flawless evening. Now, Harwood, the first time you were on the program, I believe, was all the way back in December of 2011. And you told a story about your dad. Hank hosted you, and that story has since been one of the most memorable ever told in almost 10 years on air. In fact, it made such an impression on our listeners that we often use it to demonstrate how moving stories can lift our collective spirit. So tonight, I want you to tell that story again, because for me, it reaches several layers of the human experience that most narratives don't end up touching.
Okay. Well, it touches me too. So if I get quiet, it's
okay.
It brings up some memories for me. So, I just have to breathe through it. So I always remember loving my father's hands. My earliest memories are of his hands on a typewriter. And my eye level was right about the level of where his hands were. And he would type, and so he wrote for all the local papers at the time. He was a freelance writer, wrote for the Chronicle, the Post, the Houston Press. This was in the 70s, early 70s. Anyway, there was just something about that. Also, that sound was ever present. You know, tit-tit-tit-tit-zitting, tit-tit-tit-zitting. I heard that constantly in my childhood. He also was an incredible artist, and he'd do these wonderful drawings, and he would use charcoal, so he would rub the drawings with his fingers and, you know, create shadows or contours. And he also did sculpture, and so watching his hands in wet clay was also just, there was a grace and a beauty about his hands that I knew up until, you know, his very late years. And just having coffee with him, watching him stir a cup of coffee, he would put in sugar, he would put in cream, he would stir three times and tip the spoon on the lip of the cup. And just the way he placed things, it was just like a little work of art, just watching his hands. My dad was also bipolar, and growing up, you know, a young family with an undiagnosed bipolar was really scary. And what it meant was that, you know, sometimes he could be incredibly kind and creative and funny and brilliant, and, you know, in a moment he could, you know, be unwittingly cruel to a young person, you know, and that was me and my sisters and brother. And so there were some incredibly joyful times, but there was always tension. And the way that manifested later in life is, you know, there were years that I didn't talk to my dad. My sisters for the last 15 years of my dad's life didn't talk to him. So those seeds of difficulty, you know, and just emotional distrust were constant throughout our lives. Anyway, I did do a lot of therapy, and I did some men's groups, and I learned through those men's groups to really, you know, forgive him, forgive myself. I mean, we're all doing the best we can do. Certainly my dad was. And I had breakfast with him every Sunday. And I remember one of my sisters saying, how do you do it? I said, how do what? Have breakfast with Daddy every Sunday. And I said, it's my service work. And I meant it. It wasn't fun. It was something that I had decided I was going to give to my elderly dad. And then he was 82 years old. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and it really scared me. And I got on the internet, and I looked up everything about it. I found the Alzheimer's Association, amazing organization. The Alzheimer's Association, just, you know, incredibly kind people, incredibly useful things that, I mean, you could probably get on their website right now if you know somebody that has Alzheimer's and needs some help, and it could help you right now. So couldn't say enough good things about them. One of the things they had was an early onset class, which meant that the Alzheimer's patients would go into one room, and the caregivers would go in the other room, and we'd talk, and then we'd get back together for luncheon. And I just got, you know, both of our guards went down, and I got a lot closer to my dad, a lot closer. And, you know, part of it was just, you know, looking at him and thinking, you know, one day is he going to look at me and not know who I am? You know, there was a window that was for sure closing, and I wanted to take advantage of that. So it didn't make these breakfasts any easier. he was always just, it was just hard to trust emotionally where anything was going to go. But I was looking forward to these breakfasts now. And so I'm going for this obligatory breakfast every Sunday. It's not obligatory anymore. I want to go now. And I pick him up, and we had breakfast, and so we're on the way home. And I'm driving along, and I look down, and I see my father's 82-year-old hand. this beautiful old hand. And I think, you know, I want to hold my father's hand. And so I'm driving, so I kind of waited until I got to a red light. And I stopped, and when I turned to, my intention was to hold his hand, I just was frozen in fear. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, like, what is this? And, you know, I thought, I've done all this therapy and this men's work. I mean, I can hold my father's hand. And then, you know, all these things started to come back, you know, cruel things that he might say. Would he pull his hand away? And then the light turned green, and so I started driving again. And I'm driving along, and I'm thinking, this is important. I want to hold my father's hand. And come to another red light, and I look down, and I can't do it. And, you know, I just thought, yeah, I did this men's work and this therapy. I mean, this is what I did it for. My 82-year-old dad's not going to do anything to me. I mean, he's a vulnerable old man. I just want to hold my dad's hand. And then I started thinking, you know, when I was a little boy, how many times did my dad hold my hand? Was it every day? Well, yeah, probably was. So thousands of times. But I can't do it. So the light turns, and I remember turning onto Wall, and there was a stop sign, and we stopped, and there was a woman on a bench. I don't know why, but we kind of caught eyes, and then I remember looking at my hand. It was kind of low on the steering wheel, and his hand was on the middle console. And this was the scariest thing I ever did in my life. When I took my hand off the steering wheel, it was just 3 inches from my father's hand. It was like my foot had just left a 1,000-foot bungee jump or something. And when I touched his hand, immediately his other hand came over and rested on top of my hand. And it was so comfortable. You know, it was like we had been doing it all along. It was, you know, it was just the most beautiful thing. And I'm so glad I did that, because my dad lived for 2 more years, and I can't say that I ever got closer to my dad in conversations or anything like that, but whenever we went anywhere in a car, anywhere, we held hands.
Wow. I will say that I doubt many adult children of troubled parents have an experience like that. I think it speaks so well of you that you, you know, moved your hand, that you took the initiative, that you were willing to be hurt.
Yeah. Well, and I'm so grateful. Here's an example. I'm so grateful for storytelling, because I would have never told that story. There would be no reason for me to tell anyone that, except that, you know, a topic came up at the Moth, you know, love. And then I thought, well, that was an example of love for me. It was, and then, you know, and then now, as time has gone by and I've told the story and people have said, hey, that helped me, you know, reach out, or I held someone's hand. I mean, it's.
I've heard that from listeners, from friends of mine that have listened to those shows, that have been moved by this story to make that extra effort, not knowing how it was going to go. And that's
right.
Part of it.
That's
you
right.
You've got to be willing to walk into the abyss.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And I'm glad for you that it paid off. And Harwood, thank you once again for getting me all emotional on air when I'm trying to sound like a professional radio guy and not get teary. I know this is one of your favorite stories to tell. Can you tell us a little bit more about why?
Well, I you know, have a good friend, Tacy Rozalowski, who's a terrific intellect, storyteller, writer, whatever. And she said, you know, you've told a lot of stories about men, and I don't know if she said it or if it helped me frame what I did, but I want to encourage people to take emotional risks. Those are the hardest risks for us to take. You know, like we heard earlier from Elizabeth, you know, believe in yourself, you know, to take the risk to do what you really want to do, not knowing what the result is. You know, and just, I also just marvel. I mean, this is a very direct experience, but, you know, if you look at your hands, they are these amazing things that we have, this machinery, this biochemical machine that we're in. And you look down at all the things that we have physically, but our hands are marvels. Mm. And how cool that we have this ability to touch another person with our hand. I mean, it's I love holding my girlfriend Mary Carol's hand. I mean, it's just, it's one of the most intimate things I think we ever do.
Well, you know, one thing that your story brought into my mind is my grandmother was a beautiful, sexy woman her entire life.
Okay, Greg, it's getting weird.
And she loved good-looking men. And her boyfriend was in his 80s.
All right.
And he had these hands that looked like bronze.
Oh, wow.
And everywhere we went, she would tell the waiter or the waitress, look at those hands. Look at those hands. And, you know, they've been gone many, many, many years. But when I think of my grandmother's boyfriend, the first thing I think of are these hands. And it's they do tell the story of a person. They really do. What would your father say if he was able to hear you tell this story?
You know, I read this script, and I knew you were going to ask me that question. So, you know, I wish I had some story. You know, what I'd love to tell you is that my dad would say, you know, I love you, Harwood, and something beautiful like that. He wouldn't. He just was. Right. He was a World War II era dude. He wouldn't have said anything. That's one of the reasons why this is so powerful to me is because I knew when we were driving the car and holding hands, that was the closest I would ever be to my dad.
Hmm.
It was saying everything, you know, he couldn't say, which is, I love you. It's safe for you to be with me. I support you, you know.
Right.
And so I got all of that.
And friends, you know, if you ever want that just amazing reward that comes from taking a risk, Harwood and Elizabeth have both touched on this. You actually have to take a risk. If you know what the results are going to be, if it's a safe, predictable ending, then it ain't a risk. Okay. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, and the rewards will not be what you're expecting. But if you're willing to take that risk, yeah, and if you're willing to be hurt,
yeah,
it is amazing what can come. Now, one thing you and I have discussed at length, you know, is what I touched on, tip for the tellers, is that every storyteller has their own unique way of creating a story. Do you have a typical process you go through?
You know, I'm so grateful that I have, y'all know Chris Gorman, and she's my dear friend. And
another superstar?
Yeah, she really is. And you know, just practicing and practicing with another storyteller and someone that's interested in it. I have a friend that makes film too, Sean Welling, and I run stories by him. And I just, there's a group of people that I meet with Fridays that are writers and so forth, and they'll give me little tips. But I think, like with this story, this was very much a sort of an instinct thing. There was a part of me that said, I can't tell a story about holding someone's hand. That's the story. It's like, I'm afraid to hold someone's hand, and then I hold their hand, and the end. I mean, you know, but if you know how important it is to you, and I knew how important it was to me, and then I thought about why was it so important to me, and then I thought, I don't ever not remember my dad's hands. There was something visual and tactile about this thing. And so, you know, it'll be different for everybody, but trust that creative vein, even if it doesn't seem like, you know, there's no car chase or there's no explosion.
Well, yeah, well said. You know what my least favorite question is when people ask me, what's your story about? Well, if you craft a 5 or 10 minute story,
right,
you can't say it's about when I got a flat tire. I mean, you know, just I've never figured out how to answer that question. I'm like, well, I can sit down and tell you the story, but I don't want to tell you what it's about.
Right.
Now, Elizabeth, what is your process when you come create a story?
Well, I try to think of my audience, to know as much as possible about my audience and not think about myself, but think about what I can give back to the audience, what I can share with them, that would make a difference in someone's life.
Ooh, I like that. Let me ask, do you have another maybe short story that you could share with us?
Well, when Harwood was talking about holding his dad's hand, it reminded me of holding my puppy dog's hands.
Oh, yeah.
I have three chocolate labs. Two passed away within 5 weeks of each other.
Oh.
And my last pictures were their paws in my hands. So I took a photo. But I remember my first chocolate lab, Amber, she was always, you know how you always have a missing sock in a dryer? We could never find our socks. And finally, we found piles of socks. Amber would just go around and take socks and put them in piles. But I love helping animals find homes. So I always pick up strays or adopt or rescue. Mm. So one day I helped this woman take in her two bunny rabbits. And they were both males. I didn't know anything about rabbits. I know everything about dogs. And I went on YouTube and taught myself how to build a bunny rabbit cage with these crates and zip ties, and my entire living room turned into a bunny rabbit cage. And I went out and bought all these tunnels and tubes and litter boxes, and I bought bunches of kale and treats and toys, and there I had bowls of water and rabbit food, and these were two little baby bunnies, but their food was always disappearing. I'm like, oh my gosh. I mean, they went to the bathroom a lot, but can they eat this much food? So I decided I was going to put the rabbit bowl food inside this baby blue mesh little tunnel that had a hole in it to see if the rabbits were just eating the food. So one day I put the food in, I leave the house, I come back within a couple of hours, and guess what I found? There's Amber, my chocolate lab. She has this blue, baby blue mesh tunnel around her neck, and she's walking around bumping into the walls and the furniture, trying to shake this baby blue mesh tunnel off her head. And I was like, oh my goodness, you're the one who's been eating all this rabbit food. So, yeah, but I love, helping animals. But when you told your story about holding your dad's hand, it reminded me of my labs. So I have one left, but he's not as rascally as Amber was.
You know, when I lost my 17-year-old best boy, my Jack Russell Terrier Kirby, that was, I think, the last photo I took was of his paw in my hand.
Yeah.
It's very touching.
Hold my dog's paws too.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We didn't really talk about this before the show, but it is very universal, isn't it?
It's the feeling of the skin on skin contact on a palm.
Yeah. And my dog will hold my hand. You know, he'll just put his hand on my hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Joseph, you know, you're somewhat newer to the storytelling world, but I'd like to know, you know, how did you get comfortable creating your stories?
Well, you know, I think for me, I've never had an issue with public speaking of any kind, even from a really young age. Never been, the shy type. But I think what's essential in storytelling is to experience life, to really try to go out of your way and do things and not be scared of anything, so to speak. And I try to instill that in like younger family members and friends that go experience life. You know, those will provide good stories to tell. And on top of that, I think it's always good to be transparent and to show people you can be somewhat vulnerable.
And if you never leave your circle of comfort, you're probably not going to have that many interesting stories.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right. And that, and I talked to my good friend Julie, who's listening from Portland right now. This was one of the important things we talked about. People love when you're vulnerable, you're transparent, and they can relate to that. It's absolutely essential, in my opinion.
I could not agree with you more. Next week, my friends, Dr. Warren Holloman will be our host, and his guest will be Eric Skelly and Sinjin Flynn, who will regale us with stories from the world of opera, as they retell the tales from Offenbach's Tales of Hoffmann. I know that's going to be interesting because I have listened to both these gentlemen for many years on, shall we say, another network. But they are gifts to the radio community, and I think it's going to be just wonderful to have them on the show with Warren. And my friends, I want to wish every single one of you the happiest of New Year. Please start the year knowing that your life is your story. Tell it loud and say it proud. That would be a great gift to us. If you go on our Facebook page, tell us a little bit about your story. If you think you have a story to tell, we would love to feature it on this program. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you, Elizabeth Ruiz, Joseph Especia, Harwood Taylor, for sharing your stories and for insights that both engaged and inspired us. I am proud to have had each of you as guests. I look forward to many wonderful stories from each of you, and I have no doubt that from the time you leave the studio, you will be going out and experiencing life and creating new stories in your mind that I hope we will get to share with a future audience. And Joseph, we expect you to make return appearances whenever you find yourself back in Houston from Utah.
I absolutely plan to be back. Thank you. And Elizabeth and Harwood, your stories were very, very amazing, very moving. Thank you for sharing.
I really enjoyed both of yours too, Joseph and Elizabeth.
Yes, and I as well. Thank you.
Well, I hope it was, you know, this was a fun show. You know, even when the subjects were serious, you know, this was a really nice group to have together. Well, my friends, The Vinyl Avenger is up next. Make great radio a part of every day. And while you're driving home, if you just need a little break from the day, if you're turning in for the night, or if you're just chilling out, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Above all, be good to each other. Tip well, even when you don't have to. Help when you can. The entire So What's Your Story team and I will always be searching for the next great story, and we will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
We want to thank you, the listeners, and those who contributed to our successful fall fund drive. This is Interim General Manager Larry Winters asking you to please consider a year-end tax-deductible donation to your favorite Pacifica Foundation station, KPFT. This can be done in several different ways. You can call our business department at extension.